Today's episode is brought to you by Wise, the account that helps you manage your money around the world, which is huge for travelers. I've been a customer and a fan for 10 years. The Wise account helps you send, spend, and receive in different currencies fast, and they do it all without hidden fees or exchange rate markups. This service has been so critical for me in my life as a traveler, as a nomad, as somebody living abroad. And you can join 16 million customers and learn how the Wise account can help you out on the road at wise.com/travel. That's Wise, WISE.com/travel, or download the app. This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. Now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, it's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Every once in a while, I like to pull one of my favorite shows out of the archives and bring it back into the feed. This one is from early 2020, a conversation I had with my friend Francis Tapon, whose travel resume is insane. This guy has hiked all 3 of the long distance trails in the States. He has been traveling for 5 years through all 54 African countries recently. And prior to all that, he spent many years traveling around Europe and Eastern Europe specifically, wrote an awesome book about it. And we got to do a deep dive on what he refers to as the hidden Europe, some of the places that most people don't go that you as a traveler may want to check out. So I know you're going to love this conversation. It's a great one. Enjoy the show. Thanks for listening and welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend. Let's get into it. Here is my conversation with Francis.
Pools, restaurant, shopping arcade, spa, fitness center. Ground, garage.
We are recording after we got the technical aspects of this podcast out of the way. And normally I have a long, drawn-out intro here, Francis, but I can't do it, man. Your travel resume is ridiculous. Like, I would just be reading it off, and then people would just be like, all right, when are you going to get to the interview? And then an hour would go by or whatever, and then I'd have to just give up. So I decided, we're on Skype here, I decided to just go to the store and get a beer. And crack this beer, which I'm going to do right now.
And by the way, what time is it in the morning?
No, it's 6 p.m. I'm in Norway. So,
oh, that's
not,
right.
Not
okay,
that
so
bad.
You're allowed a beer.
I've had my whole day. I've been taking care of my kids all day and everything. I'm ready for beer. No, I'm doing that because you're like, as I read through all the things you've done, I'm like, this is the kind of guy I'd want to like kick back and have a beer with and hear some stories. So anyway, Francis, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Thank you so much, Jason. Honored to be here.
I'm glad you reached out. And by the way, if you want to check out Francis's work as we get into this, you can just go to his website, francistapon.com, T-A-P-O-N. First of all, on your website, you say wanderlearn with Francis Tapon. So I wanted to just get your definition of wanderlearn, because I think really this philosophy that you have that you carry with you everywhere and in your work and everything like that. We're going to talk about your books and everything like that. But what do you mean by wanderlearn?
When you travel, you can learn a lot about everything, not just the world, but a lot about yourself, your relationship with somebody else. If you travel with somebody else or in a group, your dynamics. Travel is one of the best ways to get educated. It's a wonderful university and it's really amazing. I can say that because I went to Harvard Business School. I went to a really good school all my life. And yet I think that I've learned much more about the world, about myself, and about other people through travel. So I encourage people to just get out there. And that's the other thing is like, I do some crazy shit, but I don't necessarily believe that everybody should do crazy shit. For some people, they just need to walk around their block or go to the next city that's nearby that they've never visited. So you don't have to do crazy shit. You just have to wander a little bit, keep your eyes and mind open, and then you'll discover stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I get that feeling even though I've traveled around a bit and stuff, if I just go on a walking adventure where I live or something like that, I get that feeling again. Are you off the road now or are you still traveling? I have no idea where you're at. I see just a nondescript background, so you could be anywhere in the world.
That's right. I'm in my Al-Qaeda cave here in Mogadishu. No. where I am is I'm in California in the Bay Area, and I am writing my book about Africa. So I'm in the hermit mode, which I'm not very good at, by the way. But yeah, so that's what I got to do. I've got to finish this book sometime this year. I'm about 25% done, and that's my project.
All right, well,
at some point, you got
to
do it.
Why don't you tell everybody what you're trying to summarize in this book, which is insane.
It's 5 years of overland travel to all 54 African countries.
And you never left the continent, right?
Correct. I got in there in 2013. I finally left in 2018, never left the continent during that whole trip. Tried to climb the tallest mountain of all 54 African countries. I managed to do it in 50 of the 54. And I just had a car, drove around, picked up 3,000 hitchhikers, got to learn about the Africans, spent about 5 weeks on average in each African country.
Everybody that's listening, earmark this. Because there's going to be a part two to this podcast, and it's going to be all about that trip Francis works through some of his books, or this book in particular. So once you kind of get your hermit mode down and locked in and you've done some more writing and this book's coming out, we're going to have you back because, I mean, that's a whole adventure in itself. But you have many adventures before that we need to cover in this show. So everybody, I just wanted everybody to earmark that.
By the way, sorry to interrupt, but Jason, I'm shooting for May 25th, 2020. May 25th, 25th. The reason for that date is that is what's called Africa Day. And Africa Day is a day that celebrates, it'd be the 60th anniversary of Africa Day. It was the year of 1960 when a lot of African countries became independent. And so it was the year of Africa, they called it. And it was May 25th, and then they formed the African Union and all this other good stuff. So I'm trying to aim the book for that anniversary. It's kind of, I think, poignant. So that's when I hope to have the book out. We'll see if I can actually make it.
I love that you're not just choosing an arbitrary date, that there's some significance behind that, which is a beautiful thing. And also it helps to have a deadline on a book like that, right? I mean,
it's yes. Just, yes.
And yeah. you totally call it, because one of the books we're going to talk about today is The Hidden Europe, What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. And you were like, you sent it to me. You were so kind, because I was like, hey, can I get a copy of the book so I can check it out? Because I always like to read the books before I interview people. And you're like, dude, yeah, I can give it to you. But if you can read it, it's like 700 pages. Go for it. And you were totally right. Shamefully, I couldn't blame it on my two kids. But no, I couldn't get through the whole book. But I'm excited to hear some of the stories from the horse's mouth, as they say. All right. So did you grow up in the Bay Area? Is that where you were born?
Yes, I was born in San Francisco, California. And my mom is from Chile. My father is French.
Yeah. Tell me about that. How did they meet?
They met because of a slow elevator. I mean, it sounds kind of romantic and sexy, but actually it's not the case. It wasn't that they were in the elevator. What happened was that my dad was trying to meet this friend of his, and they were staying in a communal building in San Francisco. And the Mexican girl that my dad was going to see, and they were going to go out on a double date, that Mexican girl saw my mom cross the lobby and said, "Hey, Lucia, come join us. There's this nice French guy. We can all five of us can go out together on a group date." And my mom went to the elevator and she was pushing the button and the elevator just wasn't coming. And so that's when the Mexican girl finally said, "Listen, the elevator's not coming. It's a sign. You got to come with us. Just come." She's like, "Fine, fuck it. I'll come." Because she was like not in the mood, but she did go.
That's, yeah. I mean, it's those little moments that you wonder, all right, yeah, that never happened.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, Jason. You know, like, think about it in all the travels, like all the times, like, you went to, let's say, India, and if you had not stayed an extra 10 minutes at this cafe, you wouldn't have met this other person who then did this and that and that. It's just amazing to think about the butterfly effect.
Absolutely. And I mean, how far back can you go, right? It's like, if when I was in grade school, if I didn't have to wait in line behind that guy at the drinking fountain, I never would have met this person at this cafe. I mean, it is crazy, though. And I think about this kind of stuff often. And yeah, when you reflect on it, I mean, in the moment, they seem insignificant. But then later on, you realize, oh, well, if that didn't happen, this whole thread of my life wouldn't have happened. But
But here's the thing, Jason. I think that when you travel, especially beyond your comfort zone, you're going to set off more of those inflection points, those little kinks in the road. Those things are more likely to happen than if you're sitting on your ass doing jack shit, right? So if you get out of your comfort zone and travel, you're going to find more of those kind of, wow, those bends in the road. And it's going to take your life into so many unexpected and usually fun directions.
Well, what did it take to get you out of your comfort zone? Or was there never a comfort zone? When do you feel like you first pushed out of your comfort zone travel related?
Well, because, like I mentioned, both my parents were not born in the United States. And so from as an infant, I was already traveling to Chile, which was a big deal back then. It was a long distance and all that stuff. Nowadays, no big deal. But so I think I was already out of my comfort zone in that sense. So I never felt out of my comfort. But I would say that the big inflection point was when I hiked the Appalachian Trail. Because when I hiked the Appalachian Trail, that's when I took a long trip. It was about 4 months and hiked those 2,000 miles, 3,000 kilometers. And I realized this is what I love to do. This is my passion, is to just go out there and, you know, wander, travel the world. And that's when I really realized that this is what I need to do. This is my mission in life.
When did you first hear about the Appalachian Trail?
It must have been 1999 or so. So I got into backpacking relatively late. I was like 29 years old or 28 years old when I first went on a backpacking trip. Actually, just camping trip, really. I got totally hooked, and my girlfriend at the time and I, we just hiked around the Bay Area, and we would do these overnight trips, weekend trips, 3-day trips. And then we went to Yosemite, did a 4-day trip there. And then we just got hooked. And then all of a sudden I said, you know, this is really fun. It's fun to hike 100 miles in a weekend, or like a 4-day weekend, should I say. But how could I do like an even longer trail? And so I started investigating, and of course the Appalachian Trail came on the radar, and I was like, oh shit, let's do that. And so that's what we did. Yeah. And then that changed my life. That's completely changed my life. And that's what my first book, Hike Your Own Hike, is all based on.
Did you do that solo, that trip?
No, I went with her. She and I, we did together. And then after that, I did the Pacific Crest Trail. And then I did the only trip, long distance trail that I did, is the Continental Divide Trail, when I hiked from Mexico to Canada up the Rocky Mountains and back. And that was about 7 months. It was 201 days. It was about 5,600 miles, about 9,000 kilometers or something like that. It was a long trip. And that I did solo.
I have a question about that. I'm just wondering, were you the first person to do that or something?
Yes, right? Yeah, I was. Yeah,
all right, yeah. So was that the intention when you set out? You're like, I want to be the first person to do
this? Yeah, it wasn't like an accident, like I wing it, and I was like, hey, you know what? I've got some extra time on my hand, I might as well walk back.
I figured that much. Yeah.
Because what it is, Jason, is that you gotta, to do that feat, you have to go at such a fast pace going up so that you have enough time on the return that you don't get stuck in the winter and slogging through the Rocky Mountains in the snow. So that's the idea. So you have to commit yourself from the get-go.
I guess you went, first from Mexico to Canada and then back down?
Correct. Okay. Exactly right.
I mean, how did you feel when you got to the end and you're like, I mean, it must have been kind of a surreal moment, right? Like, it's different when you're driving to the, I don't know, to the market or your friend's house or whatever. You're like, well, all right, my time's up. I guess I better turn around, you know, and go back. But like, no, all right, I just lived through this crazy adventure that took however many months. And I guess I got to turn around and go back and do it again.
Right.
I can't imagine that moment.
Yeah, but the thing is that it's even better than a lot of people imagine, because when I got to Canada and I got to the turnaround point and I touched, there's a monument there. It's right at the Canadian-US border in Glacier National Park. And you touch that monument, you're officially, for most people, it's the end of the trail, but for me, it was the halfway point. But I had taken the hard way up. So the Continental Divide Trail is different than the Pacific Crest Trail and the Appalachian Trail. The Continental Divide Trail is not nearly as well defined as the other two trails. So there's parts where you kind of have this option. Oh, I can kind of loop around this way. I can go around this way. So I took always the difficult, most circuitous route to go north. Also, I dealt with a lot of snow because I went through Colorado in the month of May, which has a ton of snow. So you can imagine, you know, Norway's got a lot of snow in May as well. So in certain parts of it, right? So that's kind of the conditions I was going up. So on the way back, I was like, okay, now I've got a lot of time. I have time, and I'm going to take the fastest way back. I'm going to not retrace my steps all the time because I'm going to be taking the more expedient route on the way down. And it's going to be snow free. And so therefore, even in the places like in Colorado that were covered in snow, it's going to look like a different world because it's going to be the fall and it's going to have like foliage and look totally different. So for me, it was just like, great. It feels like I was doing a different, completely different trail on the way back.
So you're one of those few people that have hiked the Triple Crown, essentially.
Correct. Which
is what those three long distance trails are. And I read somewhere that I don't know if this is a fact, but that more people, I think, have been to space than have hiked the Triple Crown or something like that.
That might have been that. Well, yeah, that's probably true. Go to space, right? I thought you were going to say the moon, but space definitely. I'm going to guess the Triple Crown maybe has about 100 people who've done it, but I haven't kept up with statistics because ever since that book by Cheryl Stray called Wild, have you heard of that book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that just kicked. So Bill Bryson, when he wrote A Walk in the Woods, that just catapulted the Appalachian Trail into popularity. Then when Cheryl Strayed wrote Wild, that catapulted the Pacific Crest Trail. So when I did the Pacific Crest Trail, there was maybe 200, 300 people per season, per year doing it, 200 or 300. It's now 10 times more, Jason. You've got 2,000, 3,000 people doing it. So it's a different environment. So nowadays, I'm guessing that more and more people have done the Triple Crown, but somehow a lot of people shy away from the Continental Divide Trail because it's the longest trail. It's the least well-defined. And so as a result, there's not as many people as you think doing the Triple Crown. Yeah, it's a rare thing still.
The Continental Divide Trail, from my understanding, would that be the more of a, would you describe that as more of a wilderness hike than the other ones? Not that the other ones you're not in the wilderness, but you know, there's some culture around the Appalachian Trail, I know, and there are social elements to that, I guess. And it sounds like the PCT is growing into that a bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say that the Continental Divide Trail and the PCT are more like brothers and sisters versus the Appalachian Trail is like a cousin. So the Appalachian Trail is kind of like the social trail, just like you termed it. It's very close to civilization. You're rarely more than a day's walk from any civilization and usually just an hour or two from civilization. Just walk down, you know, take one of the what's called the blue trails, which are kind of offshoots, and you can jump off the Appalachian Trail pretty easily. The Pacific Crest Trail, because of, like you said, the popularity, it's becoming different. It's coming a little bit more, but still it goes through wilderness. I would say the PCT and the CDT are both wilderness trails as much as we can get wilderness in the contiguous United States. If you want real, real wilderness, you got to go to Alaska or Canada or Siberia or maybe Lapland. You probably can find some decent wilderness up there in Norway, in the North Lapland out there. Yeah,
absolutely. Come for a visit, man.
I did do the fjords of Norway, but I had a more adventure in Lapland in Finland when I was hiking up in Finland in Karhunkieros Trail, as they call it. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's how actually your book opens, Hidden Europe.
That's right.
Which is awesome. It's a great story where you're
locked in
really
an outhouse.
You bring us there too. You lock yourself into an outhouse, essentially.
Exactly.
And there is nobody around to save your ass.
That's right. Yeah, I was there. It was the longest day of the year. It was June 21st. And I was going to hike this whole trail. I can't remember how many miles it was. It must have been like some 50 miles or something like that. I was going to do it all 24-hour period. And yeah, you know, outhouses, they have that lock that's on the outside to keep the rodents from getting into the outhouse. And when I closed myself in, the latch just cluck, closed me in. And all of a sudden I was like, fuck, I can't get out. And it was like midnight and it was cold. It wasn't like freezing, but it was cold. And I was like, all my backpack, all my food, all my clothes were outside the outhouse. And I was banging on the door, you know, throwing my body against it. I was like, get me out of here, yelling. But of course, nobody was there.
No. Yeah. How did you?
I'll give away the ending. It's free to download on my website, but I got on my back. So I put my back against the toilet seat. And I just imagine me resting on my back with my legs cocked against the door. And then I just did like some kung fu kicks in rapid fire succession, just going bang, 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 many, many, many times. And until about maybe 20 kicks, and all of a sudden the latch just went, it didn't break the latch. I'm not that tough. it just the vibration just knocked it off.
The butterfly effect. Maybe you had to hike all those thousands of miles just to build up your leg strength to bust out of that outhouse. Otherwise, you would still be in there looking like the frozen dead guy from Nederland, Colorado.
If anybody's that's right. Been to that. That's right.
All right. So where in this whole mix of hiking, and we're going to get into some of your later travels, but I want to talk about where the career stuff fit in. You said you started backpacking when you were 29. And you got more serious about it. And then I'm guessing you did the Appalachian Trail around... How old were you when you did the Appalachian Trail?
I was 30.
Yeah. Okay. So it was like the year after you started.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got into backpacking. I went all in. And then I just like, okay, Apple. And then... so I was 30. And then about... Let me see. 3 years later, I did... No, I did Eastern Europe. And then when I was like 36, I think I was. Yeah, 36. I did the Pacific Crest Trail. And then when I was 38... I did the Continental Divide Trail.
Were you working traditional jobs up until
yes.
the Appalachian Trail? Or what were you yes. doing?
Yeah, I was working in Silicon Valley, and I would work for Hitachi, and I worked for Microsoft up in Redmond, Washington. And here's the thing is that, again, a tip. I mean, I know you cover this a lot in your podcast, but you got to learn how to live below your means. And I think if that's your goal, to travel, you got to learn to live below your means. And that's something that a lot of people struggle to do, especially in America, but I think probably in Europe as well and all over the world. And so I was making a boatload of money being paid at Microsoft and Hitachi, but I was living like a fucking student. I just paid like $600 a month just to rent a room right by the Microsoft campus. So I could just walk to the campus. I didn't have to like have a bike. All I had was a bicycle. It was just so simple. And that allowed me to accumulate what I call fuck you money. So basically, you save up so much money that you can say fuck you to any situation. So you've got a bad relationship, you're dating somebody you don't like, or you're living with somebody you don't like, or you're living in a city you don't like, or you have a job you don't like. You know, that then this gives you the chance to say fuck you, I'm leaving the situation, I'm getting out, and I'm going to wherever. And a lot of us don't have that fuck you money saved up. And that's what you got to do. And you can save that up whether you're making $30,000 a year or $300,000 a year. It's possible to save it all up.
Yeah, I guess. And if you're living below your means, that fuck you money is, you don't need as much, right?
If you're right, not, exactly.
If you don't have a lot to maintain. Exactly. So,
right.
Well, there are certain habits that kind of get built with that as well. And sometimes, I mean, for me, it was a little bit of the reverse. I started traveling and working on the road when I was out of college. So then, I got into the minimalism lifestyle because I couldn't really carry that much with me. And then I carried that with me into my regular life later on, like when I wasn't traveling as much. But of course, the reverse, if you're minimal and you don't need as much before you travel, then you're already used to kind of living without, I guess, or not living up to a certain standard, whatever you want to call that. So did you always know that you were going to take off and travel? Like, was that always the plan? Or you said you got your MBA at Harvard. Were you kind of on the career track mindset-wise for a little while?
Or yes, I was.
There what happened there? Was the hiking or what happened?
Yeah, so Harvard was to me an ultimate insurance policy. It was the, you know, if all of a sudden you've got your ripcord, you've got like your second parachute, your reserve parachute. So I was like, okay, before going to Harvard Business School, I thought to myself, okay, do I really need to go to, I don't need to go to business school to start a fucking company. Anybody can start a fucking company. You don't need to have that degree. But I said, wouldn't it be nice to have that reserve parachute in case all hell breaks loose, the company fails, I lose, I get into debt or who knows what else, and I need to just have a real job and just to survive and go out. Well, that gives me the option to always find a job fairly easily. And so I'd invested in that education in order to give me that kind of security and backup. But what a lot of people, when they go to these good school and get good education, they just follow the traditional route, as opposed to using that as a reserve parachute and say, you know what? I can now take crazy ass risks with my life and do something crazy and take a big swing at the fences and go for it all, because if I fail, I still have an insurance policy. That's my education I can fall back on.
Yeah. Well, at what point in the journey were you like, you know what, this, I am going to use this as a fallback option and I'm going to switch my life to be all like full-time on the road?
Pacific Crest Trail, that was when I finally, so 2001, when I did the Appalachian Trail. That's when I was like, okay, I discovered my life purpose. This is what I really want to do for the foreseeable future.
And you just learned that on the trail?
Yeah, yeah. I just, you know, you have a lot of time to think about it. And back then, it's also, back in 2001, there was no smartphones. There was almost very little GPS. And so you were really much more disconnected on the Appalachian Trail or any of these trails than before. I didn't have any phone with me. It was just no email. I didn't check that. It was a very different world back then. And so you really disconnected. And that gave you the chance to really sit there and think about your life and reflect in ways that I think are much harder to do nowadays. You have to force yourself to take off that stupid smartphone and disconnect. So that's, to me, what was the impetus. And then in 2006 is when I finally officially, that was my last honest job, that was Microsoft. And that was 2006. Yeah. So about, you're looking at how many years ago is that? 13 years ago. And so ever since then, I've been traveling.
And you had your FU money. So you said FU. Or maybe not. Exactly. Maybe you actually shook hands and were like, oh, let's leave on good terms. I'll see you later.
Yeah, yeah, but of course. Yeah.
You could have. Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I want to get into some of the content in your books, Hidden Europe, a little bit of Hike Your Own Hike too. But before we get into that, I just wanted to ask you really quickly, just stay on this topic of money, because it's such a big topic for people. Saving for travel, obviously, the number one struggle oftentimes is money. And you mentioned living below your means. But as far as saving money, any strategies, techniques, things that you can share that have worked well for you that anybody can implement outside of like living below your means? I would love to hear them.
Yeah, specific tips. Boy, you can do like, dumpster do you have
investments,
diving.
Certain investments or something? Were you just putting it in the bank? What were you doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I really lucked out. So 2001 was obviously September 11th that happened, and that it crashed the stock market. And this is a really, you know, one thing you learn in business school, and yet you don't need to go to business school to know this simple lesson is to buy low, sell high. So when there's blood on the streets, that's when you want to invest and make big purchases. When people are talking about, when let's say the stock market or any market, it could be the commodities market or Bitcoin, whatever thing, when people are saying, oh my God, it's already lost X amount of value, let's say 20%, 30%. And then people start making predictions like it's probably going to go to zero or the collapse of the whole stock market, the whole economic system is going to shit. Like in 2008, it happened all over again. Everybody's all this doomsday stuff like, oh my God, this is, that's when all of a sudden you're like, great. Everybody thinks the whole world's going to shit. We're on the brink of a catastrophe. That's when you want to invest and invest big time, make a huge chunk of money and put in. And I did that in 2002 and I did that again in 2009. And then conversely, the flip side of that is that when the people are talking about, oh my God, the stock market's going to go to 50,000, you know, the Dow Jones is going to go to 50,000, or, you know, Bitcoin's going to make it to 50,000, or whatever the investment vehicle, or housing prices, they're just going to keep going up forever. Eh? Well, that's the time when you want to sell your fucking house and get out of that whole thing. So, but it's very, very hard to do. It's easy for me to say that, but it's just really hard to go against the grain. But I think a lot of your listeners are people who are contrarian, people who are saying, you know, wow, everybody's looking after this career and I want to do this career. I want to do something different. I want to either travel the world or I want to travel for months or I want to go on a sabbatical. I want to do something different. And so those types of people already have an advantage. You are a contrarian thinker. You're probably going to make some good investments. And so that's where I took my fucking money and multiplied it, doubled it, tripled it. And that was a combination of luck, but also understanding the psychology of markets.
This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off the beaten path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why We're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point about travelers, the way we travel in general, just being kind of contrarian in that way and looking at it that way. I think that's a good lens through which you can find some potential either investment opportunities or just unique strategies to save that maybe you weren't exposed to growing up. I mean, a lot of times, early on at least, I mean, how you treat money or your attitude around money can be tied in with how your parents talked about it or treated it. And, you know, until you separate the psychology of that out and take it for yourself, it becomes a, you can create that conversation for yourself, but you have to kind of be self-aware to do it, right?
Right. Absolutely. And here's, let me give you a concrete example for you and your listeners, Jason. So Bitcoin, when my brother actually bought Bitcoin when it was $1, he bought 10 Bitcoins for $1. And then of course the exchange that he was holding the Bitcoin at got hacked and he lost all his Bitcoin, but it was great. He had foresight. But I remember when Bitcoin was $1,000 and then $1,200, and then it collapsed down to 200. So from 1200 to 200. And I thought to myself, this is a great time to buy. So I bought it around 250 and then it did really well. It's gone up ever since. And then again, a Bitcoin went up to 20,000 and then everybody was talking about how Bitcoin was just going to go forever up, 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 up. But I waited for it to collapse again down to 3,500. In fact, I even recorded a podcast in December 2018 and I told people, buy Bitcoin because it's going to at least double in 2019. And the Bitcoin was at that point had lost 85 or 90% of its value. It was down to 3,200. And today, as we're recording this, it's around $10,000. So it's already, you would have tripled your money in the last 6 months. So that's just an example. I'm not saying Bitcoin's going to go up forever or whatever, but the point is that it's another example of using that fuck you money, your little reserve, investing it wisely, making it grow.
On the writing side, did you always know you were a writer, want to be a writer? You came out of the first adventure writing your Hike Your Own Hike, right? That was after the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah.
I mean, what propelled you to write the book? Was it the mission that you kind of came to that realization? All right, hey, I want this to be something that's part of my life. Or did you want to be a travel writer at a certain point? Where's the writing?
Yeah. So here's the thing is that one of the questions I asked myself on the Appalachian Trail is what would I do? And this is why I ask your listeners, what would you do if you had $1 billion? Not how you would spend the money, but how would you spend your fucking time? What would you wake up in the morning and what would you do? Would you be a hairdresser? Would you like, I mean, is that what you like to do? You like to hairdress all day long? Do you like to do interior design? Do you like to play football? I don't know. What is your passion? And so whatever that is, it's stuff that you would do no matter what. And so, you know, look at Bill Gates. Bill Gates has billions of dollars. Jeff Bezos has billions of dollars, but they're still doing their things, their companies. They're not doing it for the money, really. I can't believe that. So it's just because they're so passionate about it. And so that's what I thought. And I thought to myself, huh, if I had a ton of money, what I would do is I'd just travel the world and I love to write. So why don't I just marry those two somehow and make a career out of that? Because you can make a career out of almost anything. You can make money almost doing anything. It's not easy, but it's possible.
Yeah, and you're an amazing writer, by the way. I just wanted to compliment you on that. From what I've gotten through in your book, I've absolutely loved it. We're going to talk about The Hidden Europe now, what Eastern Europeans can teach us. I love that tagline. You did something similar in Eastern Europe that you just did in Africa, right? You just decided to go and spend all of your time and go to every country, but I think you broke it up differently. Just want to give people some context on what you did here.
Yeah, sure. So I went to Eastern Europe for about 3.5 years. Actually, I went first time was in 2004 and I visited all the Eastern European countries and I was intending to write the book, but then life got to me and I decided to hike the other trails. And by the time I finished the other two trails, the book was already kind of, you know, my experience I felt was a little bit too dated. So I revisited it. Instead of spending just 5 months, I decided to spend another 3 years there. I went all in. I define Eastern Europe super broadly. So imagine if you have to divide Europe into East and West, and there's no Northern Europe, Southern Europe, no Central Europe, just East and West. How would you divide it? And so I divided it very broadly. So Slovenia and everything to the east of Slovenia, including, by the way, Finland, I included Greece and Turkey even. These, of course, a lot of people, and Russia. So a lot of people don't agree with such a broad definition, but you can, if you search for where is Eastern Europe on Google, you'll find my article and it explains.
Now, did you include those just so you could have more countries to go to?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You're like, yeah, right. We're going to include Thailand here. I think I need some beach time.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So that was my very broad definition of Eastern Europe. And I don't expect everybody to agree with it. Certainly not the Eastern Europeans. But that was the funny thing about Eastern Europe is that people in Eastern Europe just don't want to be called Eastern Europeans often, not all of them, but often they resist it, especially if they live in Central Europe, like Hungary or Poland. If you are Czech Republic, you know, those guys really hate it when you call them Eastern Europeans.
So, I mean, do you have a home base?
I would say I mean, it's my mom's house in California, and that's kind of where I've spent of the last, let's say, 13 years. I've probably spent about, if you cumulatively, maybe a little bit over a year here, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. Like, which is not very much. Maybe time 2 years.
Yeah. Maybe 2 years if you add it all up, because there's been like a few, because when my dad died, I spent more time with my mom. So that was it.
To hear that. Okay, so you're basically fully nomadic life. I mean, you just kind of dove into that with the international travel, it sounds like, right? I mean, was, as far as Eastern Europe and this whole mission for this book, first of all, why do you set up these types of missions for yourself when it comes to your travels?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I like to go in all in. So if you look at a lot of travel bloggers and a lot of nomads, it's pretty much haphazard. I mean, it's certainly a round the world ticket is, you know, I'm in Thailand, I'm in Australia, next thing I'm in Dubai, and then I'm in Kenya, and then I'm in Frankfurt, and then I'm, which is fun. It's diverse. It's you see all sorts of different parts of the world. But I kind of love to like sink my teeth into travel and to really go all in and to understand the culture, understand the people, and understand the nuances between all these places. So especially like, what's the difference between Slovenia and Slovakia, Lithuania and Latvia? You know, to me, it's you can just, if you run through Lithuania and Latvia, you're not going to really try to capture too much of that. You might say, well, they speak different languages. That's it. You know, they both have some Russian, ethnic Russian population. That's it. And you don't capture much more than that. So I think the fun part about travel is not the monuments. It's not the buildings. It's, and the food is part of it, but I just like to understand the people and the mentalities and where we have things in common and where there are differences. And how is somebody from Kenya different from somebody from Tanzania? And I understand there's a lot of generalities built into that, but to me, I just love digging into that and seeing the overlaps. And what happens is it's not a science, it's very anecdotal, but if you get a lot of data points, Jason, then all of a sudden I think it gets to be a little bit more scientific, especially when you marry it with statistics and other data that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's something also to just having that intention as a traveler, right? Because that is fueling your conversations on the ground and your interactions, right? Because you're aware of this need, this desire to kind of understand the maybe some of the cultural subtleties, why people feel a certain way, which are difficult things to understand unless you spend a lot of time in one place.
Right. And the example, one thing that just popped into my mind in Hungary. So Hungary is going to have, I think in this year or next year, I can't remember. I think it's next year. So they're going to have they're going to have their anniversary of the Treaty of Trianon. This Treaty of Trianon that happened in 1920, I believe it is such a scar in the psyche of the Hungarian people. You would never pick up on that if you're just barreling through Hungary and going to Budapest and having a fun time. But as I hung out with Hungarians, it just kept coming up in my conversations. And I was like, what the fuck is this Treaty of Trianon that they're all worked up about? It happened 100 fucking years ago. Why is it a big deal? And yet you start delving into it and you're like, wow, this is something. And this is so pertinent to Hungary. And almost nobody else on the planet cares about that stupid Treaty of Trianon. But the Hungarians, it's a big fucking deal.
Right. I mean, that's kind of like the statue you were writing about in Estonia.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the Russian statue.
That was, yeah, very controversial, and it went up at night, and everybody had like really super strong opinions on it. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's just, like you said, passing through. Oh, it sounds like, all right, well, that's just a small thing, but it's not. It's not a small thing if everybody's talking about it and it's like a huge part of their culture. It's a big thing, you know, which is a huge advantage of staying there and learning that type of, getting that type of knowledge, or you said like data points. And I'm guessing when you reference data points, you're talking about kind of these different conversations you're having on the ground and these interactions, right?
Right, right, right. So there's the anecdotal data points that I gather, but then there's also things like the Pew Research Center, like the Gallup polls, and looking at the United Nations statistics, so that you can kind of have some sort of sanity check. Like if you, with your anecdotal data, does your anecdotal data contradict some of this, you know, like, for example, I don't know, I'll give you an extreme example here. Like I go to Guinea-Bissau and all of a sudden all the people I hang out with in Guinea-Bissau are fabulously rich. And so they're all nice houses. And I say like, I don't know. I think this United Nations statistic that they are, you know, the lowest GDP per capita and one of the poorest countries in the world is bullshit, because, you know, everybody I hang out with is like really super nice. They got this great electricity and everything is working. so you have to sometimes realize that just because you got into a taxi cab and the taxi driver ripped you off or stole from you and he's Turkish, that not all Turkish people are thieves as a result. You know? So sometimes I think, and this is the fault I think that a lot of travel writers make, the mistake that a lot of travel writers make, is that they jump to conclusions based on few anecdotal data points. And I try to, in my writing, to be careful to do that before I jump to make a generalization. Does it have more data to back it up than just my 2-3 anecdotal data points?
Yeah, some of those posts out there is like, hey, I spent 3 days here. Here are the things you should do. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, you may not have seen the whole country, right? No, that's right.
How do you meet locals?
Oh, couch surfing is one of the great mechanisms. So a lot of people do couch surfing just to save money. And I just don't find it's a big money saver unless you're going to spend several days with that person or family or that host. Because I wrote, if you Google couch surfing, how to be a guest or something like that, you'll find my article number one. In fact, couch surfing themselves, the company, approached me and said, Francis, can we copy your article and put it on our official Couchsurfing page on how to be a good guest and a good host? And I said, okay, yeah, you can reuse my content. Go ahead, just give me some credit. And so Couchsurfing themselves has used my article for that. So I encourage your readers to read it if they're going to do Couchsurfing. But the gist of the article is that you got to be a generous guest and not be a selfish guest. And to be a generous guest usually costs money. And hostels are not that expensive. And so in the end, the savings is pretty minimal. And sometimes they also consume some of your time because you want to hang out with your host. You don't want to just treat it like a hostel or a hotel. But for me, as a writer who's trying to get into the psyche and the knowledge and see what people eat, how they treat the husbands treat their wives and how the children respect their parents or don't respect their parents and how the educational system is and how do people hang out how are the bathrooms, do they have running water? I don't know. Just to me, it's such a wonderful insight into the culture. And so that's how you meet locals. And of course, they're usually use you as an excuse to go out and say, hey, let me introduce you to some of my friends. So all of a sudden you've expanded that circle of connections, that circle of friends with you. So you get to really get to meet. And for me, that's what I live for. Some people, they travel for the food. Some people travel for the sights. Other people travel for the mountains, whatever it is. But for me, I just love getting to understand the people. And couch surfing is one of the best ways to do that.
Yeah, that has been one of your biggest resources, I guess, and to tap into the local culture. Like you said, meeting other people, I guess, through the host and everything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other way, I mean, a lot of cultures, I mean, there's some conservative cultures that don't let you do this, but when I take buses, trains, or any kind of public transportation, I almost always look at the person next to me and say, hey, how's it going? You know, I strike up a conversation with anybody. And just inevitably, it's just fun. It's just serendipity. You increase those butterfly effect moments. You know, that's just, It's great.
Yeah, I've noticed that you also get a little bit of a free pass as a foreign traveler, right?
Yeah.
Like I get that in Norway because one of the things that isn't really in their culture is,
yeah.
This sounds mean, but is to like talk to each other on the street.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. But Nordic, that's the whole Nordic thing, dude. It's not just...
Yeah, I mean, it's like considered impolite. So they're actually being polite by not really interacting with each other, which sounds funny, but it's like their version of politeness is from what I've learned. But I'm American. I'm super chatty, right?
Exactly,
so
right.
I can be standing in line.
You've got a fucking
wherever.
Podcast. You like to chat.
I like to chat. And I like you. I mean, I'm fascinated by people. I mean, there's a reason I have this podcast and these things. I mean, I love to have these conversations. So that includes anywhere I go. And yeah, so I can kind of start chatting with these people. And there might be a split second sometimes where they kind of give me like that, they're caught off guard type of thing.
Right, right, right.
But then, oh, well, I'm not from here. So then it's like, cool. And you find that they're like really excited to open up and they all actually want to talk to each other. They just not doing it for some reason. I mean, I can't change an entire culture. Anyway, if any Norwegians are listening, just talk to each other a little more.
Yeah,
you guys are all really nice.
No. It's the same thing. I remember the same shit in Finland. Same thing.
Yeah.
the Finns are just so insular, and even Estonia to a large extent, that just don't talk to each other. The only exception, Jason, is when they drink a beer.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's all of a sudden. Then all of a sudden, their personality opens up and changes completely.
Yeah, everything loosens up then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a generalization we can make across all cultures.
Yeah, it's probably but I don't know, because like Americans, I think in general are pretty, or Latin Americans, they don't need a beer necessarily to open up and become chatty. But the Northern European and Southern Europeans, like the Balkans, they don't need a beer to open up either. They'll just go off on you. The Greeks, the Serbians, all those guys. But the Northern Europeans, they are just closed up. They're closed up, and they need that little lubricant in there to like open them up.
It works. I'm curious why you picked Eastern Europe for this. I mean, you're dedicating years of your life to get to know each of these individual countries. And you could have taken this to South America. You could have taken this to Asia. You could have taken this a lot of places. Why did you choose to go to Eastern Europe?
Yeah, so I had known Western Europe. When I was graduated from college, I went on a 75-day trip to all the Western European countries, basically, and a couple of Central European countries in there. And I wanted to... Eastern Europe was a big, strange place to me. And so I said, okay, this is where I would like to just get to know. So I was just looking at the map, and we can all do this. You look at the map and you say, where are the holes in my map? Where are the places I haven't been to, the regions I haven't been to? And at that time, back in 2004... I hadn't been at all pretty much to Eastern Europe except for a couple of Central European countries. So I really want to explore that region. I hadn't been to Africa. I hadn't been to the Middle East. I had barely been to Asia. So there's basically a whole lot of shit that I didn't know, but South America I didn't know. So Eastern Europe was kind of like, should be fun. And Eastern Europe is also really relatively tame. I mean, you compare it to Africa, you compare it to the Middle East, it looks tame to me. And so as a solo traveler, as a young guy, just like, all right, I'm just going to give this a shot. And I'm not that experienced in traveling. It's kind of like the 101 class. If you can do Eastern Europe, then at least you've graduated and you can try something a little bit more challenging. Kind of like the Appalachian Trail is to the Continental Divide Trail, if you will.
Got it.
Yeah,
I will.
Yeah. All right, I'm gonna hold you to that.
What are some of the destinations that you'd like to highlight from that time of your life? Because for me, Eastern Europe is one of those a lot of holes in the map situations that you mentioned, and I really want to go and explore. And I've been thinking about, okay, well, if we're gonna do, you know, maybe get an RV or something, would you want to do that around the States? Like, I've done that before. Would you want to do Eastern Europe, something like that, something I haven't been. And I'm really curious as far as like what places you loved, didn't like. I mean, I know that's very subjective, of course, and those are probably too strong of adjectives to even use, like or didn't like. I mean, places are more nuanced than that, but I just want to hear a little bit more from you as what are some of those places that really felt special to you, maybe that you connected to personally.
So in the back of my book, which you, I know you haven't gone to the end of it, but it, just skip it forward. I think it's like the very last, after the conclusion, I think it is. I list like the top 10 or 15 places. Yeah, travel recommendations. Yeah. Very back there. And then I list my favorite destinations in Eastern Europe. But off the top of my head, one of the things I always bang the drum on is Qatar, Montenegro. Have you been there?
No.
Have you been to Dubrovnik?
No.
Okay, then I respect you. See, I respect you. Because so many motherfuckers, they all go to Dubrovnik, which is utterly spectacular, fantastic. It's right there on the at the bottom of Croatia, on the coastline. Wonderful place. And they don't get on a fucking bus or take a car, which just is about an hour away, maybe 2 hours max, is Kotor, Montenegro. And is the southernmost fjords. You're in Norway. You like your fjords. Well, how about fjords with a bit of warmth to them?
Yes. I like the sound of that a lot.
And how about, you know, at the base of those fjords, these pedestrian-only cities, old medieval towns that are walled up, no cars. The particular one is called Kotor, but there's a couple of other ones nearby. Like there's Budvar, there's... Presata, I can't remember how, there's Herzinovil. Anyway, these are all in that zone right there. So amazing. And so I always slap people as hard as I can, Jason, when I find out that they go to Dubrovnik and they did not go the extra mile to go to Kotor, Montenegro, because that is my favorite place of Eastern Europe.
There. Really?
Yes,
wow.
Dude.
Okay.
Yes, dude. Yes, dude. Dude, I almost bought a fucking house there. There's the tallest mountain. Yes. There's the highest house on the hill in Kotor, Montenegro. I went there and there's an old lady there. And I even made an offer to her. Back then it was 100,000 euros or something like that to just get this house that didn't even have a toilet. Like it had an outhouse and that kind of stuff. But my God, the view. So when you go to Kotor, Montenegro, you want to like hike up the hill. There's a fortress above the city. And you want to hike up to that fortress. On the way up, depending on the way you take, you might be passing that old lady's house. And when you do, turn around and look at the view. You're going to see the rooftops of this old city, the red rooftops of the old city, plus the water, the bay that's there. So you got the blue, and then you've got the majestic mountains and the behind it. So think about that. Just picture that. That is Kotor, Montenegro, best place. Not only in Eastern Europe, but probably maybe even in Europe. I mean, it's so fucking beautiful and amazing. I love it. I really love it. And I highly recommend going there.
If you love coffee like me, let me tell you how you can get an incredible cup of coffee, whether you're at home or on the road. You can use what I use, which is the AeroPress. Have you seen this? This is a device that uses a patented 3-in-1 brew technology. It combines the flavor benefits of espresso, pour over, and French press into one compact, portable device built for travel or home. The AeroPress has over 55,000 five-star reviews in 60 countries. Plus, it's the best reviewed coffee press on the planet. That tells you something. And it makes an incredible gift. Under 50 bucks. Get one for yourself or somebody you care about. Pick yours up at aeropress.com/zerototravel. That's AeroPress, AeroPress.com/zerototravel. Use the promo code ZEROTOTRAVEL, all one word, to save 20% off your order. That's 20% off. Thank you to AeroPress for the delicious coffee and for supporting today's show. Hey, you lovely listeners, Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast, and we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value totally free. Thanks for listening.
Your fjords are nice, dude. Norway's got nice fjords. No question about it. Snow-capped fjords are beautiful and stuff like that. But if you actually want to walk around in a t-shirt or a bikini, go down there. That's where you want to go, and you're going to have some nice time. Really nice time.
Have there been any other places that you felt that strongly about where you, I mean, obviously this is a big standout from I can hear your description. I'm like, my wanderlust is if you can salivate by wanderlusting, I'm doing it. You know, places that you felt like, hey, maybe not. All right, I'm not going to live here, but I could live here because it's that special.
Yeah, I liked in Africa. I really liked Mauritius a lot. I can't bring myself to live in an island country. I mean, like an island place, any island, frankly, like Hawaii. Hawaii is wonderful.
You just get island fever too much.
Yeah, it's so stupid because, you know, of course we all live on fucking islands. You're there in Oslo, right? It's not an island, but really, if you want to get anywhere, what are you going to do? You're going to get on a fucking plane, right?
No, that's true. Yeah. It's not in the middle of the ocean, though. I don't have to go super far to go somewhere.
No, but the point is that you're probably not going to get in your car and drive to Poland.
Yeah. That sounds awesome, though. I would like to do that. No, if I had a car. Yeah, okay, right. But I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. Yeah.
In other words, we're all living on islands. You can live in Chicago and you're like, yeah, you're not an island. But effectively, to go, unless you really like to drive across Kansas and Nebraska, you're probably going to get onto a plane. So in some ways, all I'm saying is that this whole thing, like, I don't want to live on an island. I don't want to have island mentality, island fever. Yes, but a lot of it's just nowadays with planes and the cheapness of planes, everybody gets on a fucking plane. So everybody's living on a fucking island effectively, in a sense. So anyway, but having said that, I think that you've got Mauritius is a wonderful African island. It's off the east coast of Africa. And it has a nice blend of Indian culture mixed in with sub-Saharan culture. And it's developed. It's not, it doesn't have a lot of the infrastructure and headaches that the mainland Africa often has. And it doesn't have the racism of South Africa. And so it's just a wonderful blend. And I enjoyed it a lot. That's definitely another place I could theoretically see myself living in as well.
Do you ever have that dilemma with yourself when you're traveling around? Because nomadic, traveling around for years, and you said, you know, you have the FU money, you're doing your travel writing, you could go anywhere. Do you have those moments where you think, should I settle down? Maybe I'm thinking about, like, not settling down, because that's, again, too strong of a word for travelers. I don't know, just that sort of dilemma of, hey, how long do I want to keep traveling, or should I set up a base somewhere? Do you deal with that at all from time to time?
I definitely do. I mean, I just got married about 3 years ago, and that was a big, big, big fucking decision. I had never been married in my life. I was 46 years old when I finally married this woman from Cameroon, and it was a real challenge. I was just like, oh, shit, commitment, something constant. And then, you know, women are going to ask for, I mean, not just women, but even men. I mean, they want a base, that kind of stuff. So it's always been on my mind. It's something that I've postponed, and it's something I think all nomads face. There's that, you know, I was talking to Gary Arndt, another travel blogger, and, you know, he finally, you know, has his place up in Minnesota up there. What's with travel bloggers living in these tundra places, like you up in Norway, Gary Arndt up in Minnesota, because you don't like the beach. You guys can live anywhere, but anywhere.
Like you, I met my wife while I was traveling. So,
right. She's not Norwegian, is she?
She's Norwegian. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's why you're there. Okay.
So
okay.
Yeah, there's a lot cheaper places to live than Norway.
Yeah, no shit.
You don't want to know how much this beer costs. So.
Oh yeah, I know. Probably $8. I'm sure. God, it's crazy. But yeah. Anyway, so by the way, and speaking about places to settle, I'm a sucker for Gallup polls and Pew Research polls and that kind of stuff. And Gallup does a really good, a lot of research. And one of the things that they do is look at the happiness of people and how happy, how much they laughed yesterday and how much, you know, just general culture. And the people in the Americas, especially Latin America, you know, so Americas, including Canada and United States, but the Americas, but especially Latin America, are the happiest and joyful people in the world. And I think that weighs so much. And maybe I'm biased because my mom is from Chile. But by the way, Chile is probably the grumpiest of all the Latin American countries. So I don't think it's that. And my mom definitely can be grumpy. But the point is that I think when you're choosing a place to settle down to and live, nowadays, especially in the globalized world where you can get any, you know, G5 technology phone, you can get internet, high-speed internet, almost anywhere on the planet nowadays. And you can order almost anything from anywhere. That nowadays you should really think about what's the culture and the people around you? Because that makes, yeah, you can create any community that you want, but you can't create the country. You can like pick your friends. You can have my 5-10 great friends that I see regularly, and they're all wonderful. Not like the, you know, but you can't make the whole country. And so to me, that's another region of the world that I would certainly consider living in, is Latin America, just because I always have a smile on my face in Latin America. And not just me, but everybody on the street in general is very happy. And that just makes you feel great.
Yeah. So you're 3 years into the marriage. It sounds like you're still traveling and doing those types of things. Are you, are these like multi-year adventures?
So we got married. So we met in Cameroon, but we got married in Zambia by the Zambezi River, off the Zambezi River near Victoria Falls in Livingston. And then from there, Rejoice and I traveled to 31 African countries together. And so we had a great time doing all that. And then we went to Europe and we visited a bunch of countries there. She really wanted to go to Norway, by the way, but we didn't have time. So she loves Scandinavia for some reason. She's just high on her list. And I think it's because she likes tall, blue-eyed, blonde people. So that looked like Thor. And somehow she ended up with me, a short, balding guy. But anyway, but the point is that we came back to America. Then we took Amtrak across America. We visited about 18 states on the way. And we came back here. And so now, the last year, she came here almost a year ago. By the time this recording comes out, it will have been a year that she's been in America, and she's studying to become a nurse. But anyway, the point is that we have next on our radar is the West and Central Asia. Have you been there? West and Central Asia, Jason?
No, not really. Are you talking about like Mongolia and places like that?
That's probably Central Asia. Yeah, but I would say the Stans is the border of the Stans. So Kazakhstan.
Oh yeah,
is,
no, kind of high on the hot list, yeah. Of course, like everything else that you've talked about. I want to go everywhere. Like
exactly.
But, yeah. That's the next region.
So that's the Central Asia, and then Western Asia, which nobody refers to it as Western Asia, but it really is the Middle East. It's another word for it. And so that includes all the Arab countries there and Iran, etc. So that will be my next thing. And that's where Rejoice and I will be traveling again together and explore that region. So that will be fun. It's a little bit harder with her because she has a passport from Cameroon and she's not an American citizen yet. And I don't think she's going to become an American citizen by the time I want to go off to Western Central Asia. So we'll have to work on that. And I was blessed because I have 3 passports. My mom is from Chile. My father's French. And so I have Chile, European Union, and American, which really gives me some travel options. It's really nice.
Oh, yeah. You're pretty much set.
But what about you? Is Norwegians, like, are they tight to the fist and they don't give away passports very easily?
Yes. They just voted to allow dual citizenship.
And, oh, great. Great.
Yeah. So I don't know what the requirements are yet, but I'm working towards the permanent residency. If I get that.
Wait. You don't have permanent residency yet and you're married to a fucking Norwegian?
No, I have a family immigration visa. So you have to stay. Well, that's a whole other conversation, but you have to stay some years until you can even apply for permanent residency. So yeah, it's a process.
Even if you're married, let me tell you this. In Donald Trump's America, even despite this, Rejoice got her permanent resident visa before she set foot in America. She had never left the African continent. And in Africa, they gave her a permanent, green card, basically a permanent resident visa. Boom. And so she's a permanent resident. Boom. Even before she came here.
How did you guys meet? Now that we're on the topic.
We met on an application called Badoo, which is like Tinder. Does Badoo exist in Norway?
I don't know. I'm not on dating applications.
Everybody Dude, why know. Are you not so on dating duly, applications?
What duly
you,
like, noted. Duly noted.
Listen, wife, over here. We're all recording. So Badoo is kind of like Tinder, basically. It's a way to meet people. And so I just was in Cameroon, and I was just, there's a cute girl. And I wrote to her, and then we met, and then all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I really like this chick. And so I was like, wow, let's go travel together. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to put her through the ringer and take her to the romantic destinations of Nigeria, Central African Republic, and Congo. And if she could survive that stuff, then she can travel easily to Paris or Oslo. Yeah. So we got along great. We did camping. We did, we slept outside with the mosquitoes and under a mosquito net, the humidity and all the discomfort, you know, hard to get a shower, that kind of stuff. And she did it all very well and with a good smile and with a good attitude. And I was like, wow, we really get along great. So, hey, we should make this a long-term partnership. So there we go. That's how we met. Yeah.
I mean, must have been at that point also a little bit more open in some way, right? Because you kind of mentioned before being a single traveler and, you know, spending all these years doing this type of travel. Were you, I don't want to say closed off, but were you kind of protective of your, hey, I'm going to be single and I want to just kind of keep this lifestyle? Were you always open-minded to that sort of thing?
No, like, for example, when I was in Estonia, when I entered into Eastern Europe, and in fact, I write about it a little bit in the book as well, when I met this girl named Mayu, and Mayu Reisman was her name, and I met her on a trip, and then I really, you know, loved her and felt, you know, I really kind of enjoyed being with her. And she and I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail together. So, you know, I set off. So just because I was in travel, it wasn't like I was closed off to the idea of getting into a serious relationship. In fact, I've always been attracted to non-American women, you know, anybody who's kind of foreign. I remember, I'm going to say a politically incorrect joke. There's this thing kind of like, what's paradise? Paradise is an American home, a Japanese wife, Italian cooking, and can't remember the other thing. Like, anyway, you get this thing. But I remember the flip side, what's hell? Hell is a Japanese home, German cooking. And then finally, it's the punchline is American wife.
Making fun of the Americans.
right. Anyway, the point is that... I never was attracted to, I shouldn't say I never was attracted to, but it's just like, to me, I always liked the exotic and the different for me. And so that meant meeting somebody abroad. And I love speaking different languages. My mom spoke to me in Spanish all my life. I went to a French school for all my life. And so I just wanted to meet, and Rejoice speaks five languages, and three of them are African. She speaks English and French. And it's just, I just enjoy the exoticness and the fun and being different. I like that. And so part of the reason of traveling, and in some ways you could argue, is like looking for a perfect partner, a perfect wife, somebody like that. So that's, you know, it took me about 120 countries to find her, but I did.
If you love to travel, and in that way too, where you're gone for years at a time, I think it's good to be open and not close off to it, really, because you could also have the mindset of like, well, hey, like, I can't really meet anybody until I settle down. But I mean, I met my wife in a hostel, so, you know, to me that was like already a pre-qualifier. I'm like, all right, she's willing to stay in a hostel and, you know, share bathrooms and all that. That kind of says something about her character, and she's traveling by herself through South America. Okay, cool. You just checked a bunch of boxes already. Yeah. So that's there's that too. I mean, you're going to find that thing that's in common, and that's something you want to share with each other. That's a great thing. So anyway, congrats. This hermit mode you're in right now, I want to talk about this because you're used to being out and interacting with locals and having adventures and just being on the road. Is it hard for you to come home and compile this information and turn it into a book? Like, what do you like about that? That sounds pretty rough.
It does, but I love to write. I just enjoy writing. And the hardest thing, Jason, is just putting away the distractions. The internet is just so evil. Not evil. It's not like I'm like, it's not that I spend a ton of time on Facebook. You know, I have these applications that track your time on all the bullshit internet sites. Right. And
which one do you use, out of curiosity?
Rescue Time, I think it's called.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just curious because that's always a good to have some resources for people to check out.
So, but the point is that I really don't, I spend a lot. I look at Wikipedia. I look at news stuff. I do I look at academic papers. You know, I'm actually spending a fair amount of time doing relatively practical things. I also have a safari company, and that takes up some of my time, and that's another story. And I'm helped. I just have too many distractions. What I really need to do. When I went to Croatia, and I was up in the northern Croatia along the coastline, I did not have internet. And I did not have internet for like 9 months. And Jason, those were the most productive 9 months of my life. And I loved it. There was nobody in the village. It was winter time. It was a summer village. And nobody was there during the off season. And so I just sat there and wrote and wrote. I would stare at my screen for 12 hours and have a smile on my face, a stupid grin on my face while I'm writing. And that's just what I like to do. So to me, it's fun, like taking complex ideas and making them understandable. It's fun to try to summarize my experiences and put and sprinkle a bit of humor in there. I just enjoy it. I don't know why, it just is. You know, for you, maybe you just enjoy talking with people, you enjoy the podcast, and that's just your passion. People are like, hey, dude, Jason, how do you do this shit? You got to sit there and you got to do the editing and you got to like do these meetings and you got to talk to these people. I'm like, dude, and you're probably like, but I like it.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. Yeah.
You're not like, to you, you're not suffering. And so, you know, this is great. And so it's the same way I feel about writing. And I just enjoy sitting out there and write. So I do miss the travel, definitely. And I'm eager to go out again. And I will go out again. But I need to finish this book. Not so much because it's going to be a moneymaker, but mainly because it's just a way of kind of capturing those years of my life, sharing a bit of the experience, and maybe inspiring a few other people like me who want to go out there and explore Africa, for that matter, or anywhere.
Yeah, you mentioned kind of Cheryl Stray and Bill Bryson doing that for certain hiking trails. And I would imagine that's one of the exciting things for you putting out these books, is that you might be able to do the same kind of thing for other people to open up some of these spots.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I hope so. I mean, I think a lot of people have phobias about Africa and that are unjustified. And I hope that when people read, and same thing, actually, frankly, back when I wrote my book on Eastern Europe, people were like, oh, Eastern Europe, that's exotic travel there. You know, nowadays it's not so exotic, but still, there are still some people who are like, I don't know, I'm going to Belarus. And Belarus is a bit exotic for Europe. It's true. But, you know, you're not going to get murdered there. You're probably not going to get robbed. You know, it's just like, hey, just go for it.
Yeah. What is your relationship with technology when you're traveling?
Because I'm a bit older than the millennials, let's say, I probably have a bit stronger, it's a bit easier for me to release the smartphone and to release the connection than I think people who are in the millennial generation who grew up with this stuff. But I grew up in Silicon Valley, and so from the age of 12 or 13, I had a computer and I was, you know, into this stuff. So it's not like super easy for me either. But I do think there's been a lot of talking about this whole subject and more research being done about how the downside of being overconnected is. And so as much as I try to encourage people to get offline apps, to go into airplane mode, to sometimes not buy a SIM. Like I buy a SIM, when I was in Africa, I bought a SIM card for every country I was going into. But sometimes I wouldn't even buy a SIM card if I was only going to be there for less than a week sometimes, or I didn't really need it. I was like, even though it was just like a dollar to buy a SIM card, I'm just like, you know what? I just want to be disconnected. I don't want to buy a data plan. And in Africa, you're really fucking disconnected because there they don't have Wi-Fi a lot of places, or not even fast Wi-Fi. I remember in Eritrea, for example, I would go to internet cafes and I'm like, how's the internet connection here? I would go to my fifth internet cafe and they'd be like, oh, here, it's really good, really fast. I said, great. Before I pay you the money to like buy an hour's worth of time like I did in the other four internet cafes, just load CNN.com for me or just any website. And I would just sit there over their shoulder and wait for a minute to go by, 2 minutes to go by, and it still wouldn't load. I was like, you know what? Thank you, but for me, my definition is not fast. Anyway, so the point is that definitely technology is, it's a wonderful thing. We talked about couch surfing earlier, Jason, and you know, we wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the internet. And so, but still, as much as possible, put down the phone It's easy to say, I know it's hard to do, but that's to me, and turn around and look at the people around you, get strike up a conversation. You know, you talked, Jason, about maybe renting an RV and going around Eastern Europe. Great idea. Like, I encourage people, any form of transportation, to go around. But if you do an RV, pick up hitchhikers. Try to, if you do occasionally, like, you have to park the RV, you can't park it in the middle of downtown sometimes, you know, take that bus into town and strike up conversations. I think it takes, just like smartphones are hard to put down, it's also hard to turn around and look at the people that are sitting around you when your wife or your travel partner is with you. And that's another challenge. So you have to kind of like get out of that shell, get out of that artificial bubble that you've created when you're traveling. And when you're traveling with somebody else, and to just say, you know what? I'm not going to talk to my travel partner. I'm actually going to, we're going to make an effort together, perhaps, to strike up a conversation with some random person who's near us. And I think that's something else that we should do more often.
Yeah. And another, a good intention to set, right? Just bust out of the bubble. Try to bust out of the bubble, and it can change the way you approach your day. It can change the activities you choose. It can change the types of meals you select or places you go. Can change everything, really. It's crazy how a mindset or an intention when you're on the road can really flip your day around in a totally different way, as long as you're like aware enough of like the experience you want to have and saying, okay, maybe these things aren't going the way I want. I want to meet more locals. How can I do that? Let me try some different things, because you do have to make the effort for sure. Before I let you go, I want to hear about some of the up-and-coming destinations, some places that you think probably prime to explode or might explode soon. The book's called Hidden Europe, but I feel like Eastern Europe is becoming, it's still hidden. I feel like this is one of the reasons why I love this book, because you're giving a deep background on each of these countries and some of those subtleties culturally that we talked about before, as well as mixing in with the humor and everything that you talked about, which you do a fantastic job of. And I'm just curious, you know, some places that you've highlighted, I'm sure, might be places that become popular here in the next, you know, 5-10 years. So like, what is like, hey, get to these places sooner than later before they get ruined.
Yeah, well, there's, I guess, Dubrovnik, we talked about earlier. I think that's where they filmed the one of the latest Star Wars episodes. I can't remember, it's episode 8. They filmed it. Do you know about this?
No, I should.
Or maybe, no. You are wearing a Star Wars shirt. Yeah, no, but sorry. I'm confusing things. It's Game of Thrones, which I've never seen a single episode of Game of Thrones, but I think that was filmed in Dubrovnik. Am I right about that?
I'm not sure. That sounds familiar. I haven't seen it either.
Okay.
I've read all the books, though.
I could be right about both of those things. Maybe they were both filmed, one of the Star Wars episodes. Anyway, I'm sure somebody will chime in later. But the point is that Dubrovnik has gotten on the map for some years now. I first visited in 2004, and it was still relatively unknown compared to what it is now. But Kotor, as we talked about earlier, is definitely on the list.
How do you spell that?
K-O-T-O-R, Kotor. St. Petersburg is a classic destination that a lot of cruise ships go to, but a lot of people just don't go to because the Russian visa can be a pain in the ass to get. But I love St. Petersburg. We're just talking about Eastern Europe now. Now, Africa, I think as they continue to develop and as they put more pavement, like Ethiopia has really kicked off relatively recently. And Africa, the place in Africa kind of shifts depending on where there's conflict. Like, for example, Mauritania used to be big 20, 30 years ago, but Mauritania has really suffered recently. North Africa was a big tourist destination for a long time until a lot of the Islamic terrorists kind of made it undesirable for people, and a lot of the revolution that's going on in Egypt. But I would, if I were you, go to, you know, take advantage of like the Egyptian pound, for example, is so down against the against the euro and the dollar. It's such a travel bargain. People totally exaggerate the amount of fear. So at one point, maybe Egypt's kind of, we look at Tahrir Square, oh my God, there's going to be protests. And then nobody goes to Egypt. And yet it's perfectly fine. You know, give you an example. When Norway, you guys had several shootings, right? Mass shootings, right?
Well, there was one big one some years ago that got...
But there was other violence. Was it there? They had some violence. I remember there's a couple of shootings there.
Not since I've been here, thankfully.
Really? Okay, okay, yeah. Okay. Maybe I'm confusing it with some other Scandinavian country, but I could be confusing it with like Sweden or something like that. But anyway, I just remember there was that big one was like on an island or some resort. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that some people, I'm sure it affected the tourism of Norway. And, you know, like all of a sudden, people didn't go to the fjords because there was some shooting in Oslo, which like makes no fucking sense.
Right, right. Yeah.
It's like worlds apart.
Well, it's 24/7 news cycle. And you know, yeah, if you're looking at the media for like to feel secure about your traveling, you're not going to get it there.
I mean, like another perfect example is like people didn't go to fucking South Africa because there was Ebola going on in West Africa, but they were happy to go to Southern Spain, which is a lot closer to the Ebola outbreak than South Africa. It's like they like blacklist the whole continent because there's an Ebola outbreak for a few hundred people or you know, a few thousand people at that point, you know. And you blacklist it, just really let's put our thinking caps on. And this is again going back to the anecdotal evidence versus statistical evidence data points, right? And anecdotal evidence is like I heard somebody got robbed in Egypt, so therefore I'm not going to go there because there's a bunch of fucking thieves in Egypt or whatever. And we got to look at statistics. What's the realistic chances? How many thousands of tourists go to Egypt and how many of them actually get stuck on a bus that gets hijacked or gets shot up in the Sinai? You know, very few. So,
well, anyway, I'm sure you have personal examples with some countries you visited that might get bad press, but then you found tremendous hospitality.
Sudan, example. Perfect example. Sudan. Dude, one of the things that was tough about Africa sometimes is that Africans, you know, they're poor, largely poor, and they're constantly begging and asking. It's exhausting, you know, pay for this, help me do this, give me this, give me that. But when in Sudan, out of all the 54 African countries, never did I feel so many people, ran into so many people who said, no, I will pay for this drink for you. No, I'm going to, you know, give you this meal. No, don't pay for me, you know, whatever. Just simple things like that. It's like, wow. I remember one guy even paid for like a ticket on the bus. She's like, no. So it's just like that was, but what do you hear about Sudan? You hear about the Darfur, you hear about the protests on the street. And well, granted, right now as we're recording this, there have been some protests. But I went there just last year. And I was traveling through Darfur, I was traveling through all over Sudan, and it was magnificent, magnificent. Not so much Darfur because I did have military escort there, but for like northern Sudan, where I've seen all the pyramids that they have, it's and just meeting the people. My God, what a disconnect! What a disconnect between what we hear about in the news and the experience on the ground. So really, just. You got to drum that into your listeners, encourage them to stretch a little bit beyond their comfort zone, go to places that seem a little bit off the beaten path and a little bit scary, just fucking go for it. And you're not going, and probably you're going to ask yourself, huh, I lived, I survived. In fact, I had a great time. Maybe I should repeat that and go to someplace else. And you're going to love it. You're going to love it.
And this is a good, reminder that you're going to have to tune in for part two when this book comes out, because yes. We have a whole continent to cover here with Africa and a continent worth of stories. So would you be willing to come back on and share some of those stories when that book drops after you've sort of coalesced all that information and put it down?
Yes. And the publisher is my agent is really begging me to keep the length down. And I'm like, but dude, I went to 25 Eastern European countries and I wrote 750 pages. And now I went to twice as many African countries and you want me to make it half the length? Dude, that's going to be hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm working on it. It's heartbreaking. It's like, it's really tough when you have some fascinating experiences and you just can't write about it. You're like, no, it's not fascinating enough. And I'm like, okay, it's a high bar. So,
you always have the blog, I guess. And if you want to just share where everybody can find your stuff in case I missed anything.
Sure. One, if you want to go learn about the Africa 50, you can go to africa54.com and that will take you right to the Unseen Africa page. If you want to listen to my new podcast, which is called Wander Learn, just go to wanderlearn.com. And then yeah, that's good enough. I guess you can, yeah, if you somehow remember my name, Francis Tapon, then you can go to that. So, oh, here's the last thing I'll mention. All my social medias, F as in Francis and Tapon. Just think of tampon without the M. So T-A-P-O-N. And so F Tapon is my username everywhere. You can go to ftapon.com. It's just the easiest way. So whatever your thing is, you follow me there or connect with me there. Thanks.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time. And yeah, I look forward to finishing the book that I already got from you, Hidden Europe, so I can figure out where I'm going to go. Obviously, Couture is already on that list. And then we'll circle back and hear, get the bucket list going for Africa, I guess.
St. Petersburg, have you got that on the list too?
Yeah, I put that on the list as well. Yeah, okay, hosting this podcast is causing me to create some kind of list that I don't even know how I'm going to finish it one day, but I guess I'll find a way. Francis, man, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Glad we finally got to connect. Yeah, look forward to chatting with you again. Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you so much, Jason.
All right, take care.
Bye.
There you have it, my chat with Francis, and he's been all over. The dude's been everywhere. And like I said at the top, I think it's a very cool thing to spend such quality time in one concentrated area. I mean, you could say Eastern Europe's not super concentrated. It's pretty spread out. But you still get to explore multiple countries. You get to go deep and learn things that you would never learn if you were just passing through. One of the many benefits of slow travel, and maybe slow travel is something to consider to lessen our impact, to do more regional slow travel where we go so we can eliminate those multiple long-haul flights. Something to think about. Thanks for taking time to hang out and listen to this show, be a part of this community. If you want to stay in touch further, you should go to zerototravel.com and sign up for our email list. I send out an email mostly every week, and there are some helpful links there. I keep you updated on recent podcasts and just share stuff that I think is useful, interesting, fun. So you can sign up over there. And we do occasional workshops and live events online and in person. So if you don't want to miss those, you want to meet other people in this community, or you want to hang out with me, I always love to meet people that are part of this community. So that's how you can find out about that stuff, by hopping on the email list. So if you haven't done that, just head over to zerototravel.com and sign up over there. And you'll hear about some exciting other stuff yet to be announced coming up here. Stuff off the podcast that you can't get here. Anyway, thank you for being here. I'm going to leave you with a quote from Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev. Probably not pronouncing that name correctly, so forgive me, Sadhguru. He says, "In turning inward, life opens up dimensions and possibilities unknown." There you have it. A little food for thought at the end of the show. Thanks for being here. I'll see you next week. Have a wonderful day. Smile. Take a chance today. Go buy a stranger a coffee. Maybe turn your phone off and leave it at home for a day. I don't know. Do something different, because it's fun, because it's life, and we only get one. So it's always fun to experiment with your days. Have fun with it. And I'll see you next time. Thanks for your time. Have a great day. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.